The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Potosky. This week, we hear from enfant terrible of the web, Andrew Keane, about his new book, Digital Vertigo. We're also looking at the latest information on the Microsoft tablet announced this week. Charles Arthur talks me through Nokia's latest woes after the announcement that 10,000 employees will be shown the door by 2013. And we focus on two trends: high street supermarkets making significant moves into the digital market, and governments attempting to manipulate our access to content via Google. Charles, you join me in the studio.
Welcome. So I do.
Yes, indeed. You're here, which is nice.
Yeah. Well, it's unlike last week.
Yes, indeed. I know. Well, you were on holiday. You're looking...
No, I was at WWDC in San Francisco, watching Tim Cook and Phil Schiller and Scott Forstall sort of do their stuff.
And did anything leap out at you that was, you know, that wasn't in, that hasn't already been written?
It was interesting. The crowd was interesting. I mean, I've been to a few Apple announcements, and those were, you know, usually led by Steve Jobs, though Phil Schiller had done a few. And those usually had the sort of the adoring crowd, whereas this one was a much more in-tune crowd. The developers are really smart, and they really know, they can get a joke, they can see the joke coming a long way ahead. Or they can, you know, they can see the implications of things happening. So it's a much wiser crowd, I think, than the average that you get those Apple ones.
And what was the feeling without Steve Jobs there? Because, you know, was there a bit of reverence? Were there any shrines?
No reference at all to him.
None.
Not the least.
And was he missed, do you feel?
Tim Cook isn't quite as engaging. He doesn't have that sort of presence on the stage. And to be honest, I thought he actually lost his way a couple of times when he was doing his short introductions. So it's nothing like the sort of two-hour tour de force that Steve Jobs used to do. But Scott Forstall is impressive, and Phil Schiller is always good, actually. He's very underrated, Phil Schiller. It was interesting. Very interesting talking to the UK developers out there who showed me an interesting time in Mel's Diner and places like that, which are great places where everyone gets together to have breakfast before the actual show.
I do like Mel's. Well, we won't be doing our San Francisco special or even our San Francisco travel guide this time, but who knows, in the future, if we get budget, perhaps we could.
Or sponsors.
No, hey. Sponsors, indeed.
If you'd like to take us to Mel's Diner, get in touch.
Indeed, yes, that would be techweekly@guardian.co.uk or directly to Charles, charles.arthur@guardian.co.uk. Show us the money. However, this is now Tech Weekly from The Guardian. As we speak, Microsoft is expected to announce a new tablet in Los Angeles on Monday evening, UK time. The rumors and the briefings to major US outlets suggest that there will be some kind of deal with Barnes & Noble, and some kind of content deal too. And to top it all off, this will be a Microsoft-branded tablet rather than carrying a hardware partner's name. Charles, why now?
There's a couple of reasons. Microsoft is getting ready to release Windows 8, which is going to formally announce at the end of this month on July 27th. And it's fallen a long way behind in the whole tablet space, the media tablet space, as analysts call it, which is, you know, things like the iPad. So it's had the software for a while. Windows 8 has been tested. It's tablet ready, rather than being sort of a bit, you know, knowing about tablets, which Windows 7 was, it really was a bad experience trying to use Windows 7 on a tablet. Windows 8 is good for it, and Microsoft has been working on an app called Smart Glass, which had announced at E3, the E3 Games Conference in LA, which is a sort of app that works on smartphones and tablets. So if you have a game, or if you're watching a TV show, for example, what they showed was you're watching Game of Thrones, and on your tablet or your smartphone, you get, say, a map of Westeros and some, you know, details about the characters showing on that. So you have the sort of the two-screen experience. And we're speaking ahead of the launch, and the expectation is that there's going to be something to do with Smart Glass, that there'll be a Microsoft tablet. earlier in April, it had a deal with Barnes & Noble, $300 million deal, investing in the Nook. And the expectation is there's going to be a sort of Nook bookstore on this tablet. And that it's going to be a Microsoft tablet because that's the way to create the reference design. And the interesting thing about this, the interesting thing is that they're doing this at this time, they're spiking Google's guns because Google has got the Google I.O. conference coming up on June 27th as well. And it's expected to launch its own branded tablet. And by doing this at this time, Microsoft is saying, hey, we've got books, we've got content, we've got a tablet. You know, and it's Windows. It's, you know, the biggest of them all. And this starts to make Google actually look like, you know, the third place in this, where Android tablets haven't sold well, the iPad has sold extremely well. Microsoft, if it gets its heft behind this, especially with Xbox users, you know, this could really fly.
Well, there are a whole bunch of tablets out there now. I mean, you've got Samsung offerings, you've got the Playbook from RIM.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, remember that one. So it's not just the three horse race. What can Microsoft offer that the others can't?
Well, the special thing that it does have is the Xbox interconnectivity, Xbox Live. There's the fact that because it's Microsoft, it has this really powerful connection with Barnes & Noble, the Nook deal. Okay, so it's not quite the same as Amazon and the Kindle, but but the expectation is you'll be able to get Kindle apps as well. And it can put its marketing heft behind it. You know, Microsoft has billions of dollars at its disposal. If it wants to put it, you know, a marketing push behind something, it really can.
Will it be cheaper, do you think?
Cheaper than the iPad?
Well, I think one of the reasons for the success of things like some of the Android tablets and the Samsung machines is the price point is lower than the Apple iPad.
The question of whether those tablets have been successful in the market is actually a pretty hard one to measure. All the data suggests that they really have not sold to any extent. So the iPad has about 60% of the total tablet market, and the Android tablets are around about 38%, which leaves sort of 1% perhaps for the Playbook, 1% for Windows tablets. And that 38% for the Android tablets is spread among dozens of manufacturers. None of them has anything like a dominant share. So although it seems like it's big, they're not actually making any headway. And once Microsoft starts to come into the space, then people, I think, are going to be saying, so I buy the iPad or I buy the Microsoft tablet?
It's interesting.
What's compelling about the Android?
We do seem to be moving into walled gardens again, as opposed to this kind of openness. If you have a relatively closed system like the Apple iPad and you've got a Windows product. There was an interesting quote this week in The Guardian in an article about this from Michael Cherry, an analyst at Directions on Microsoft, which is a research analysis firm based in Redmond, Washington. He says, if Microsoft wants to control the entire user experience and the entire quality of their products, they have to build their own hardware. Is this in fact what they want to do?
I think that that they do. I mean, for Windows 8, they're seeing this as really important. So, for example, they told HTC that it could not make a Windows 8 tablet because HTC wanted to change what the home screen looked like. And Microsoft just said, no, we're not going to have this. Actually, you know, our home screen is how we want it to be. I suspect, just thinking off the top of my head, but I suspect that walled gardens are a sort of stage that you see when a technology or a field is comparatively young, when it's still in its explosive stage, which tablets are at the moment, partly because it means that you can control the experience. And when you have a new technology, a new experience, then you need to lock it down to a certain extent so that people aren't left going, okay, now I have to press this button, this button, this button, this button, this button.
Yeah, it's interesting because that's when these technologies become entrenched, isn't it? And that's when the architectures of them become entrenched, which has implications ultimately for our user experience and how devices are built in the future. Look at the iPhone. It was a real departure, and now that set the standard for how we interact with devices moving forward.
It is, but at the same time, once those technologies become mature or become widely spread, then that technology becomes dial tone. You know, it's just the standard of how things are done.
Yeah. Well, more on this obviously as the press conference happens, and you can follow that story all week on guardian.co.uk/technology. Earlier this week, Google released its latest transparency report. I literally just found out about this today. I think it's an absolutely fascinating, compelling read and an insightful expose of the removal requests and data information requests that the service gets from copyright holders and governments. And this is the fifth in a biannual data set of the activity around the flow of information via Google and its services. Now, specifically, this report identifies a worrying trend in terms of how these invested parties, governments and copyright holders, are trying to curtail the flow of information. In The Guardian this week, Dominic Rush reported that there's been an alarming rise in the number of takedown requests by governments, from political speeches to anti-establishment advertising. Charles, what is this report?
Google, unlike other companies which have large search shares, or even any search share, actually puts out data about how many times it's had these sorts of requests. There are similar data kept at chillingeffects.org. Twitter is one of the companies that submits information there about how many takedown or removal requests it has had. So Google's not alone in doing this, but it does this in its in this sort of way. By breaking it down this way, it's more easily visible, though that Chilling Effects site is pretty useful as well. Really, what it's doing is it's saying, whenever a government or an individual logs a request to remove data from the Google systems, then it logs it.
Does
and,
this,
and reports it, if
some,
it can.
Yeah, if it can. I could see how this works on something like their Blogger service, mm-hmm. Because that's content, or on YouTube, because again, that's content. But how would they do it? It seems in some ways that this is almost a misunderstanding of what the Google service is. Would it be able to remove it, say, from its search listings? How? I don't understand.
It's not about removal from search listings generally. It's about things like, it is about the actual Google-owned Google-owned products. So it's interesting, looking at the UK one, the content removal requests, the largest number, there's 49 requests to remove items from web search, which come from the police or the government, which may be to do with anti-terrorism legislation or anti-racism legislation. They don't actually specify. And it's interesting that for YouTube, again, the largest number of items requested removed was 729, and those came from police and government over issues. The principal issue was national security, where there were a number of terrorism videos that were removed. The other one, though, the biggest one is actually for AdWords. So that's where there's disputes about ownership of AdWords, or where it's felt that the use of AdWords for advertising alongside search results is actually misleading, or is in effect ripping people off.
Why have they observed an increase in the takedown requests, do you think? Is it that governments are starting to become a bit more savvy about how to manipulate the content that's on the web? Is it that, we have reached now a level of maturity with this medium that
I think it's
organizations
twofold.
Are starting to...
I think it's twofold. I mean, first of all, governments are more aware of the importance of the internet, and they've got themselves organized so that they can make these sorts of requests. And secondly, a lot more people are using the internet. Things like... videos that are used for the encouragement of terrorism. So in the case of Stephen Timms MP, who was attacked by a constituent who had been watching these sorts of videos on YouTube, it's sort of a two-way process. So Google is getting it, in effect, because there are more people putting this sort of content up, and the government's more more aware of the importance of getting it down.
To what extent, though, given that they're self-publishing this, and I think it's an incredibly valuable resource, as you say, there are other services are available, like Chilling Effects. But to what extent are reports like this a smokescreen for us to say, hey, Google's great, it's out there, it's showing us all this stuff, when in fact there's stuff that's going on behind the scenes that they don't really want us to look at? So, for example, also this week in The Guardian, Cory Doctorow commented on the way that Google is increasingly curating its content, whether it's by the alleged promoting its own services at the top of the list, or using algorithms that generate higher results for so-called valuable sources. In some ways, is the transparency report and all the other positive things that Google does and waves its hands at. A PR exercise, simply distracting us from looking deeper.
I think these things will go in parallel. I mean, it's easy to say, oh, bad government, you're getting people to take more stuff down. You know, this is that it's a restriction of speech. But is it necessarily? I mean, you know, the YouTube videos that have been taken down at the request of the Association of Chief Police Officers, you know, those are things which actually people have been saying for a long time. You know, this stuff, not good. You know, so it's easy to misinterpret, I think. And I think a lot of caution needs to be used in saying, oh, you know, more of these sorts of things, therefore that's bad. You know, there were none back in 1995. Does that mean that governments, you know, weren't trying to restrict speech, or equally that bad people weren't trying to do bad things in those days? I think that
gone wrong since the internet, Charles.
Yeah, it's the interwebs. Blame the internet. Well, it's to some extent you can say that you know, this sort of transparency is good, but actually you just need more transparency. What is the content? Can you actually say you need to be able to dig as deeply as possible into it?
Yeah, and it was interesting. I won't sort of go into the details, but you know, the U.S. made 6,321 requests for users' data between July and December 2011, and Google complied with 93% of them. We have no idea what that is.
Well, Google says requests for user data include those issued by U.S. authorities on behalf of other governments. Seeking legal assistance, treaties, and other diplomatic mechanisms. So it may be where, say, you know, where a foreign country is trying to find out the identity of someone who has posted on a Google service of some sort or other. If the request is done, and if there's a mutual treaty between the US government and Google, well, Google's ruled by the laws of the US, where it's operating there. So, you know, it's compelled to. It just means that, you know, in 7% of the cases, the affidavit or whatever just wasn't presented right.
Yeah, well, I think it is important to remember with this that it's across all of Google's services. It's not just its search. So, and it has a lot of services. It is the former world mobile leader, but this week Nokia's downward spiral continues. After cutting the payroll of 4,000 employees, not to mention the cull from a few years ago, they're set to lose another 10,000 employees by 2013. And the tailspin is collecting momentum after an announcement last week about their quarterly progress. Bond ratings agencies downgraded the handset manufacturer's stock to junk status. Charles, is this recoverable?
It is, but it's going to be the most amazing conjuring trick that's been pulled off. Nokia could just about make it if it can get enough low-priced and high-priced Lumia handsets into people's hands by the end of the year. If it has a good Christmas this year, then the signs are encouraging. If it doesn't, then things start to look terminal, to be honest. And that's not something I've thought about Nokia before. But the Jean-Louis Gasset, who's used to be an Apple executive long before the time of Steve Jobs, has a piece on the Guardian website today. And he points out that along with this, the amount of cash in the company is 4.8 billion euros, 24% less than a year ago, 13% less than the immediately preceding quarter. Now, we're going to get Nokia's numbers in sort of late July, so the quarter that we're in presently. And it's going to be important to see how well it's doing in managing the cash, because what it really needs to have is cash to market the new handsets. One of the overlooked things about being a successful handset manufacturer, especially in the smartphone space, is you have to have the backing of the carriers. And to get the backing of the carriers, you effectively have to be giving them incentives to sell your handsets. That's what Samsung has done really well, and that seems to be what Apple is doing really well. The carriers have a big incentive to sell their handsets. So, for example, the Samsung Galaxy S3, which was launched at the end of May, you know, there are actually direct cash incentives for people for the carriers' salespeople to be selling those.
And that requires pots of cash.
That requires pots of cash. Nokia hasn't got those pots of cash. Microsoft has, and they've got a Microsoft, Nokia marketing deal. But Microsoft seems to be a little bit distracted at the moment. It's just not getting the momentum there.
It's not just the marketing deal that they have, though. When Stephen Elop, who's the chairman at Nokia, came in from Microsoft, he basically jettisoned Symbian, the Symbian operating system, and said, that's it, Nokia handsets are now going to be using the Windows mobile system.
It's sort of, well, yeah, people think that's what he said. But actually what he said was, we're going to sell another 150 million Symbian handsets. It is starting to look like a strategic mistake for him to have announced that tie-up when he did, 10 months before the phones were ready. And, with Symbian still there and actually still selling comparatively well. Really what he needed to do, this may be hindsight. It is hindsight, really. But it may, strategic when people come to look at this in business schools, because, Nokia is absolutely certain to be a case study for business schools in the future. It's either going to be how the right strategy kills you, or it's going to be, how Stephen pulled off the turnaround of the century since Apple's one. So announcing that in January of 2011, that he was doing the tie-up with Microsoft, and then making people wait 10 months for the first handsets, that really starts to look like a mistake.
And finally, in the news this week, supermarket Tesco's bought the London-based digital streaming music service We7 for £10.8 million. Charles, do you know what the terms of sale are? They've got quite a high proportion of the stake.
They've bought 91% of the shares directly, and they're just negotiating to get the other 9%. But it's a pretty good deal. It's it's a UK tech success, and it's interesting that it's a UK bricks and mortar company which is buying them.
Yeah, this seems to be a trend. We've noticed sort of HMV has decided that it wants to move away from its diversification and going back into selling hard stuff, physical stuff, and bricks and mortar. And Sainsbury's bought HMV's stake for £1 or something like that in Anobi, which is an ebook reader. So we're starting to see this as a trend. Bricks and mortar companies are starting to buy these digital products.
Well, if you look at Tesco, they bought Blinkbox, which is online video rental, last year. And if you tie that together with what they're doing with We7, and if you look also at the way that Tesco.com is a really big online retailer.
Across the board, trying to rival Amazon or something?
Well, yeah, really, if you think about it, they're trying to be a sort of, in the UK, they're putting together an Amazon-like portfolio, really trying to get themselves together for a position where they can challenge Amazon online. But at the same time, they have lots of stores that people go and buy their bread and fruit in.
It's an interesting hybrid, isn't it? And I don't think we've seen this. Not really seen this model before, have we?
Never really had the chance to see this model, because you haven't had supermarkets that have been big enough or which have had the concentration on the internet sufficiently before to make that sort of play. But I think it's a sensible play. It makes a lot of sense to be able to do things like this. I mean, don't forget, Tesco's been doing things like phones and broadband, and it's had a mobile phone service for ages. It's trying to be a bank. There's not really any area that Tesco isn't interested in getting into. So, streaming services, why not?
It's kind of like the Google of the bricks and mortar space, isn't it? In that Google just tries a whole bunch of stuff. And some of it floats and some of it doesn't.
Yeah, though Tesco's pretty good at just the nuts and bolts of the bread and fruit.
Indeed. Well, find out more about all of these stories at guardian.co.uk/technology. In 2007, Andrew Keen published a critique of Web 2.0 culture titled The Cult of the Amateur, with the subtitle, How Today's Internet is Killing Our Culture and Assaulting Our Economy. Good old dystopian Andrew. Well, The Cult of the Amateur was an attack on user-generated content such as MySpace, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, and was the kind of anti-zeitgeist in many of the popular books that were coming out at the time, like Clay Shirky's Here Comes Everybody. He wrote that blogs, podcasts, amateur videos, and music weren't just an inadequate replacement for mainstream media, but would swiftly kill it off. Well, now he's back with a new book, Digital Vertigo, and he's got his sights set on social networking and the move towards transparency. Charles met him.
What is your objection then to social media? I mean, Twitter is a worldwide thing. There are hundreds of millions of people using Twitter-like facilities in China, where it seems to be quite important for things like people being able to express opinions that they wouldn't have been able to before. What do you find that you don't like about the way that it's framed at the moment?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the book is very clear. It's not saying that people in China, for example, or people in Iran or Afghanistan or Syria or Egypt or Thailand shouldn't be using social media. In fact, it's not saying anyone shouldn't be using social media. I'm the last person to tell a grandmother that they shouldn't be Skyping or tweeting with their grandchildren on the other side of the world. The book is a little bit more nuanced, perhaps, than my first book, which was an outright, unambiguous attack on the internet. It suggests, though, that the social media architecture, which we are collectively falling into and which is being built from Silicon Valley, is worrying for a couple of reasons. It's particularly worrying because of the culture of what I call voyeurism and surveillance, which I think is emerging out of the architecture of an internet we might call Web 3.0 or an internet dominated by big data, a world in which we are continually watching each other and being watched both by companies and the state. So that deeply worries me. And I'm also concerned with what I call the digital narcissism that social media, I think, encourages, the idea that we should be perpetually broadcasting ourselves, what we had for breakfast, what we think of this and that. And I don't think it's necessarily reflecting us in our best way. But most seriously and profoundly, what disturbs me and what the book is about is the way in which social media is turning us inside out. We're destroying privacy. We're destroying our inner world. We're living more and more in public. Mark Zuckerberg wants that. Jeff Jarvis wants that. Many entrepreneurs and social thinkers inside and outside Silicon Valley want that. I think that's a mistake. And I think we're heading for a world where privacy will be destroyed. And I think that that's a disaster for us as a species.
Now, there are two separate things there, because you talk about companies and corporations wanting to surveil us and wanting, in effect, to mine the data about us. And then you talk about people not having enough privacy, being narcissistic, wanting people to look at them. I mean, these are two separate things, aren't they? So let's deal with them separately, because you, for example, have a Twitter account, but you, like everyone on Twitter, you can choose what you put out there. You can choose how much of your life and what sides of your life you choose to allow to be visible there. Very much the same with Facebook, other social networks. You can choose quite what parts of the prism you allow to go out there, can't you?
I think you can. I do. And as I said, on Twitter, and I'm not on Facebook, but I am on Twitter because as a writer, I have to be. It's a perfect platform for me to distribute my brand, my supposed skills. For anyone listening, I'm at AJ Keen. I hope everyone follows me. I have two responses to that, and this is a question that always comes up. Firstly, people like you and I are media professionals. We're very skilled at inventing and reinventing our brands and identities on the social media. So I don't think we're particularly good examples. I think the better examples would be so-called digital natives, people who are growing up in this world, as well as people from my own generation who seem to have no real understanding of the implications of much of what they're publishing. But there's a second point as well. I'm not just a cultural conservative. I mean, we're at The Guardian, so I have to be a little bit radical. I'm not saying that digital narcissism is the only reason we use social media. I think that we're seeing these, and I write about this in some detail in the book, we're seeing these deep structural shifts from an analog industrial 20th century economy to a digital network 21st century economy. And I think that's increasingly defined by us not working for large organizations and increasingly becoming self-employed. And so these platforms become ways in which we distribute our brands in the 21st century. So in some ways, I'm not saying that we can give them up or we should give them up. Many of my solutions, actually, in my solutions chapter are about reforming from within, working with them. The hero in the book is John Stuart Mill, because I go back to the middle of the 19th century and I say, look, a similar thing happened then. A similar thing happened in that technology, the Industrial Revolution, created this network world which impinged on the autonomy and innovation of the individual. Mill wasn't a Luddite. He wasn't saying that we should knock the factories down and go back to the village. He wasn't a romantic. He wasn't a conservative. And I understand that we have to live within the realities of digital society. I quote the Social Network movie, the fictional Sean Parker in the movie, when he said, first we lived in villages, then we lived in cities, now we live online. And he's right. So this is a big issue, and it's not something that can be just solved with a Daily Mail attitude of pulling our socks off, and not socks off, that was a Freudian error, pulling our socks up and not being narcissistic. I think even narcissism itself has a peculiar 21st century quality.
So then what would be your advice to, say, a 13-year-old today who, you know, has just reached the age where they can log on to Facebook, they can log on to Twitter, they can, you know, log on to all these social networks? What would be your advice to them, and more generally, you know, just to people listening?
Yeah, I would rather do it to people listening, because I don't want to turn this into a generational debate, partly because I'll lose. If I appear to be this old fart telling young people that they've gone wrong, I'm made to look ludicrous. I don't think it is a generational issue. And I think ultimately the reform will actually come from 13-year-olds who are much smarter with this media than older people. In fact, one of the reasons I got off Facebook was because it irritated me that people of my generation would be pasting all these photos of their kids all over the place without any sense of asking the kids or thinking of the long-term repercussions. So my advice to everyone, men and women, young people and old alike, is to hold something back. Is to remember that the miracle of being alive, of the human condition, is the complexity of our inner world. And if we embrace all these services, we've talked about Twitter and Facebook, everybody knows about them, but, you know, listeners to your show also know about all these other social services and apps. Think of one like Highlight, where if you go on Highlight, people know where you are all the time. Think of Glancy. Think of Waz. Think of all these food sites and social television and social reading. My warning to people is if you join all these networks and everything you do can be observed by everyone else on your network or even publicly, you're ultimately, I think, doing yourself a disservice, because I think the core value of who we are is our mystery and our secrecy. And I think that people will come to regret it, whether they're old or young. It doesn't mean switching off. I'm not a Luddite. I'm not saying I'm as wired as anyone. I'm on Twitter. I'm not on Facebook. So make selective choices. But don't embrace the whole thing. Don't believe, as some people argue, that this radical transparency of publicness will benefit and add richness to your life, because we'll all become like Jeremy Bentham's. We all become corpses, and we more and more reflect what I would call the digital utilitarianism of Silicon Valley, which forgets about our core humanness.
Andrew Keen speaking with Charles Arthur. Well, that's it from us for this week. Many thank you, Charles. And you can read up on all these stories at guardian.co.uk/technology. And keep up with the latest headlines as they unfold throughout the week. If you want to find us on social media, all of the links are at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. I'm Alex Kratosky. The producer this week was Simon Barnard. We're back next Tuesday. See you then.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.